This is a Power Broadcast program. More information at powerbroadcast.com.
Today, we're not just analyzing sources. We are plunging into one of the most intellectually charged and ultimately Nobel Prize-winning arguments in the entire history of science.
We really are. We're tackling the true, verifiable nature of physical reality itself.
We're going to war with our own common sense, really. Facing down the ghost that Albert Einstein himself created, you know, his spooky action at a distance, and wrestling with an even bigger philosophical demon, one that just refuses to die.
The possibility that our universe is completely, totally predetermined.
Exactly.
This is truly foundational material. Our mission here is to navigate that core conflict between the revolutionary predictions of quantum mechanics and that comfortable classical intuition we all have.
The idea that the universe has to be local, real, and predictable.
Precisely. We're targeting three specific assumptions that really form the bedrock of classical physics. The first is locality.
The universal speed limit, the speed of light.
Right. Then realism.
The idea that things have properties, even when we're not looking at them. The moon is still there if I close my eyes.
Yes. And finally, the most controversial one, statistical independence, or what we sometimes, you know, shorthand as free choice.
Our source material for this is just epic. It spans nearly 90 years of physics, starting with that famous 1935 Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox paper.
Which was a pure piece of philosophical reasoning. There was no experiment.
None at all. And we're going all the way up to modern empirical tests, the kind that use light from quasars that are billions of years old. And the material really forces us to ask, what exactly did experimental science force physicists to give up?
And we'll chart that whole course. We'll go from the philosophical challenge to the mathematical proof, that's Bell's theorem, and then to the decisive experimental verdict, the loophole-free tests.
The ultimate goal here is to understand what happens when all those classical loopholes are finally closed, when we're left with only one remaining really radical path for preserving locality.
Superdeterminism, a theory that demands we sacrifice the very idea of independent scientific inquiry itself.
Okay, let's unpack this journey. Let's start where this whole seismic shift began, the 1935 paper, published by Einstein, Boris Podolsky, and Nathan Rosen.
Right. And as you said, this wasn't an experiment. It was a pure thought experiment, a Gedanken experiment, designed to expose what Einstein saw as the sheer absurdity of quantum mechanics.
The title, I think, it just says it all. Can quantum mechanical description of physical reality be considered complete?
Exactly. The EPR paper was a direct, calculated attack on the reigning paradigm of the day.
The Copenhagen interpretation.
The Copenhagen interpretation, primarily championed by Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg. Einstein's conviction was simple. He believed that QM, for all of its incredible predictive power, had to be incomplete.
It was missing something.
He was missing something because it couldn't account for all the inherent physical properties that he just believed must exist in the physical world.
But before they could even argue that QM was incomplete, they had to, you know, lay down the law. They had to define what reality even means. So what was this EPR criterion of reality?
It's beautifully simple, and it's so heavily reliant on classical intuition. They established this key principle. If, without in any way disturbing a system, we can predict with certainty.
Certainty meaning 100% probability, no doubt.
A probability of one. If you can predict the value of a physical quantity, then that quantity is an element of reality.
Okay, that seems reasonable.
Like, it seems perfectly reasonable, and it relies inherently on two things. First, the property must exist. That's realism. And second, the act of measurement must be local. It cannot instantly affect something far away.
Right. So how did they use this seemingly simple criterion to go on the attack against quantum mechanics?
Well, they used their thought experiment. It involves two systems. Let's call them Particle 1 and Particle 2. They've interacted in the past, and now they're separated by a vast distance.
What we would now call an entangled state.
We'd call it an entangled state, yes. And they focused on two mutually exclusive properties, position, which they called Q, and momentum. P.
And I think we need to pause there for a second. Why those two? Why specifically position and momentum?
Because of the big one, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
Of course.
Quantum mechanics states fundamentally that certain pairs of properties like position and momentum are incompatible or non-commuting. The more precisely you know one,
the less precise you know the other.
Exactly. QM formalizes this. It says a single particle cannot possess definite simultaneous values for both. They just don't have a shared element of reality at the quantum level.
Got it. So EPR is trying to force QM to admit that particle 2 does have definite values for both, even though quantum theory says that's impossible.
Precisely. That's the trap. So let's run the thought experiment. They show that by measuring only particle 1's momentum, P1, you can instantly deduce particle 2's momentum, P2.
Because of conservation of momentum.
Due to the law of conservation of momentum. Now, since particle 2 is miles away, the measurement on particle 1 could not possibly have disturbed it. That's locality.
So by their own criterion of reality.
By the EPR criterion, P2, the momentum of the second particle, must be a real existing thing, an element of reality.
Okay, and here comes the pivot, the choice.
Here comes the choice. The experimenter could, instead, have chosen to measure the position of particle 1, Qone. And because the particles were entangled to conserve their position relationships, you can then instantly deduce particle 2's position, Q2.
And again, you haven't touched particle 2. So thanks to that non-disturbance premise,
Q2 must also be an element of reality.
So wait, particle 2, which was never touched, has to have definite values for both position and momentum at the same time. At least according to this classical logic based on locality and realism.
Yes, but QM says that's forbidden, and that is the core of the paradox.
The conclusion they drew was really sharp then.
It was a stinger. They said, since the particle must possess these two simultaneous definite values, these elements of reality, and yet the quantum mechanical wave function does not contain these values, then the quantum mechanical description of reality is incomplete.
I must be missing something.
Those famous hidden variables that would predetermine the values of P2 and Q2 all along.
Now, I know the original position momentum example is mathematically pretty dense, which is why the later revision by David Bohm is what we usually hear about. He used spin or polarization.
Right. Bohm's variation made it so much easier to grasp because it simplified the variables.
Yeah.
It went from these continuous quantities like position to discrete binary outcomes, essentially yes or no, up or down.
Like flipping a coin.
Exactly. Yeah. Imagine two particles emitted in what's called a spin singlet state. All that means is their total spin has to be zero. So if you measure particle A's spin along, say, the z-axis, and you find its spin up,
you instantly know particle B's spin along that same axis has to be spin down.
They're perfectly anti-correlated every single time.
And here's the kicker. If particle A and particle B are space-like separated,
meaning they're so far apart that a light signal couldn't have traveled between them in the time it takes to do the measurements,
then that instantaneous determination, it looks a lot like information is breaking the speed of light.
It looks exactly like that. And that instantaneous correlation is what Einstein famously and very dismissively labeled spooky action at a distance. Spukhaften Fernwirkung.
He just found it unacceptable.
Completely. For Einstein, physics had to describe events locally. Cause and effect had to be transmitted through, you know, continuous neighboring interactions, never instantaneously across empty space.
But the prevailing view at the time, the Copenhagen view, was defended by Niels Bohr. How on earth did Bohr counter what seems like a pretty devastating paradox?
Bohr's defense was, well, it was subtle. It hinged on rejecting the EPR criterion of reality itself, specifically their use of what we call counterfactual reasoning.
So he was attacking their premise. He was saying you can't talk about what you might have measured.
That's the heart of it. Bohr argued that you cannot treat the conditions for specifying predictions as separate from the quantum system itself.
So in other words, the choice you made to measure momentum is inseparable from the result you got. And the choice you didn't make to measure position instead is, it's just irrelevant, doesn't correspond to any reality.
Exactly. Bohr stressed that the entire experimental arrangement, the measuring device, your choice of setting, the system itself, it all forms an inseparable whole. He argued that statements about measurements you didn't actually make have no physical meaning.
This sounds an awful lot like that very fuzzy, difficult concept of the Heisenberg cut.
It does. The Heisenberg cut is that boundary, and it's often a bit nebulous, between the quantum world, which is described by wave functions, and our classical world, the measuring device that clicks and gives us a definite outcome.
So EPR wanted the property to exist before the measurement.
Right. And Bohr argued that the measurement process, this irreversible physical interaction that results in a classical record, is what creates the defined property. It doesn't just reveal a pre-existing one.
So for decades, you've got this complete philosophical stalemate. Einstein says locality and realism are non-negotiable, so QM has to be incomplete.
And Bohr says QM is complete, but we have to abandon our classical idea of inherent, definite properties that exist before we look.
How do you possibly settle an argument that's this deep?
You introduce mathematics. You find a way to translate those philosophies into cold, hard, statistical predictions, and then you go into the lab and you test them.
And that brings us to John Stuart Bell and his incredible work in 1964.
Yes. Bell didn't really take sides in the Bohr versus Einstein debate. He just asked a very pragmatic question. If Einstein is right, if the universe is truly local and real, what mathematical consequences must follow from that?
He found a way to test the philosophy.
He did. Bell's breakthrough was recognizing that Einstein's assumptions, that combination of locality and realism, which we now call local realism, that combination imposes an extremely stringent statistical constraint on how correlated two distant particles can be.
He turned a metaphysical disagreement into empirical, quantifiable science.
He did. It was an absolute game changer.
So let's clearly define the type of theory Bell was going after. These local hidden variable theories, or LHV theories.
Right. And LHV theory is any theory that tries to save our classical intuition. It says the randomness we see in quantum mechanics isn't fundamental. It's an illusion.
It's just a lack of knowledge.
Exactly. It says that particles carry specific hidden variables. We call them lambda, which are like little instruction sets fixed at the moment of emission. And these instructions predetermine the exact outcome of any future measurement.
But crucially, these hidden variables have to obey locality.
They absolutely have to. The measurement outcome of particle A can only depend on its own hidden variables and the local setting of detector A. It cannot be instantaneously influenced by what's happening light years away at detector B.
This sounds impossibly complex to calculate, but Bell somehow managed to boil it all down to a single testable number, the Bell inequality.
He did. And let's focus on the most commonly tested form, the one developed by Clauser, Horn, Shimoni, and Holt. The CHSH inequality.
Okay.
Bell proved mathematically that any theory based on the principles of local realism must satisfy a statistical upper limit on the correlation you see between those two entangled particles. That limit is the Bell inequality.
And in the CHSH version, there's a specific number.
Yes. If we define this correlation quantity, which we call S, based on measurements at four different settings across the two stations, local realism absolutely demands that the magnitude of S must fall within a very narrow range.
It must be less than or equal to 2.
That number 2 is the absolute hard limit for any classical local real universe.
Okay, but why 2? Is there an intuitive way to understand why local hidden variables can never produce correlations stronger than that?
There is a decent analogy. Imagine you have two classical objects, say, two dice A and B, and they're entangled in a classical way. They always give the same result when rolled. The underlying property, the number on top, is the hidden variable. It's real and it's local to each die.
Okay.
Now, you can test correlations by asking various questions, like, is the number even? Or is the number greater than 3? When you ask the same question at both A and B, the answers are perfectly correlated.
Of course, they have the same number.
But when you start to mix and match different questions checking for even at A and greater than 3 at B, the classical correlation starts to break down in a very predictable way. The absolute maximum correlation strength you can measure, based only on that pre-existing local information, simply cannot exceed a specific statistical boundary.
And that boundary is quantified as 2.
That boundary is 2. So if you accept locality and realism, the universe is statistically limited in how weird it can be.
Right. Now compare that classical limit to the quantum prediction.
This is the critical part. Standard quantum mechanics, which, as we know, rejects realism and implies non-locality, it predicts that entangled particles will show correlations that violate the inequality.
They will be greater than 2.
Quantum mechanics predicts that the value of S can reach a maximum known as the Cyrielson bound, which is 2 times the square root of 2.
Which is roughly 2.828.
About 2.8. And that is a colossal distinction. You have a classical theory that can never, ever get past 2, and a quantum prediction that explicitly allows for values all the way up to about 2.8.
It's not a small difference. It's not a rounding error. It's a clear line in the sand.
It's the smoking gun. Yeah. And suddenly the whole experimental protocol becomes crystal clear. You assume local realism is true. You derive the inequality, thought all is 022, you go and perform the experiment. And if the value of S you measure is statistically greater than 2,
then the assumption of local realism has to be wrong. It's falsified.
It's definitively wrong.
So what does a Bell violation actually demonstrate? If we go out and we measure, say, S equals 2.5, what fundamental principle have we just been forced to give up?
The violation demonstrates that the correlations you see between the particles cannot be explained by any mechanism where the properties are contained solely within the individual particles themselves, you know, the local hidden variables.
So you have to drop at least one of the core assumptions.
You must. And the most straightforward conclusion, the one most physicists accept, is that we have to drop locality. We have to accept that spooky action at a distance is real.
But that's a really important distinction, isn't it? The non-locality that Bell's theorem shows. It doesn't let us build a faster-than-light telephone.
It does not, and this is a very common misconception. The results of the individual measurements are still fundamentally random.
You can't control the outcome at your end to send a message.
Exactly. While the correlations between the two distant points are non-local, that randomness ensures that neither observer can control or predict the specific outcome of the other measurement. They can only confirm that the spooky correlation happened after they get together and compare their notes.
Which has to be done using a classical slower-than-light channel, a phone call or an email.
Right. No instantaneous communication of usable information.
But what about the people who refuse to drop the idea of hidden variables, the realists?
Well, if you absolutely insist on keeping hidden variables, then you are forced to abandon locality. The most famous example of this is the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation.
Bohmian mechanics.
Right. It successfully reproduces all the predictions of quantum mechanics by proposing hidden variables that are guided by something called a quantum potential. And this potential instantaneously spreads throughout the entire universe.
This is explicitly non-local. It has faster-than-light information transfer built into it.
It does. And because of that, it's considered anathema by most physicists who hold special relativity dear, even though it's mathematically complete and consistent.
So once Bell's theorem was out there, the philosophical debate moved decisively out of the journals and into the lab.
It had to. And starting with John Clauser's early tests in the 1970s, and then the really refined work of Alain Aspect in the 80s, and Anton Zeilinger more recently, the experiments have consistently violated the inequality.
Over and over again.
Consistently. They have validated quantum mechanics over local realism, and the evidence became so overwhelming that it earned Clauser, Aspect, and Zeilinger the 2022 Nobel Prize in Physics.
But that journey from the first violation to the Nobel Prize, it was defined by this relentless pursuit of perfection. Specifically, the need to eliminate any technical flaws that could let local realism sneak back in through the back door.
These were the infamous loopholes.
Let's define these. The first major hurdle was the locality loophole, or the communication loophole. How did LHV proponents use timing to argue against the early tests?
Well, they argued that in the first experiments, the time interval between the first measurement and the second one wasn't strictly space-like separated.
There was enough time.
There was just enough time for a hypothetical local signal traveling at or even a bit below the speed of light to communicate the setting of detector A over to detector B before the measurement at B was finished.
So if that were true, the correlation could still be explained by a local classical signal. No spookiness required.
Exactly. So to close this loophole, experimenters had to do two things. Massively increase the physical distance between the detectors and ensure the measurement settings were chosen and completed in a fraction of a nanosecond.
That sounds incredibly difficult from an engineering perspective.
Oh, it's astounding. Tittle and his group in 1998 used fiber optic to separate their labs by several kilometers. Later, in 2008, Sollert's team achieved an 18-kilometer separation.
18 kilometers.
And at that distance, they could definitively ensure the measurement events were space-like separated. It ruled out any possible local communication signal. The sheer feat of keeping single entangled photons coherent over that distance is mind-boggling.
Okay, so that takes care of the speed of light problem. But the second major weakness was often even harder to eliminate. The detection loophole, also called the unfair sampling loophole.
This one is tricky. The early photon detectors were notoriously inefficient. Sometimes they'd only catch, say, 10 or 20% of the photons that were emitted.
And the LHV proponents pounced on that.
They did. They argued that the small subset of particles that were actually measured might be biased. They suggested that the total population of particles that were emitted did satisfy the classical limit of 2.
But the detectors were only catching the special pairs, the highly correlated ones, and missing all the ones that were behaving classically.
Exactly. They were arguing for an unfair sample, which was giving a false positive violation.
So to close this, you just needed better detectors.
Much, much better detectors. You had to achieve extremely high detection efficiency. Depending on the specific inequality you use, it's typically above 83%.
And that was eventually achieved.
It was. Anspin and others in 2009 made huge strides using superconducting solid-state devices. They could capture nearly 95% of the particles emitted. The only downside was their physical separation was limited to just millimeters.
So they closed one loophole but opened another.
Right, which is why the ultimate achievement, the thing that really cemented the consensus, was the loophole-free verdict reached around 2015. Several teams managed to close both the locality and detection loopholes at the same time.
Both of them in the same experiment.
Yes. For example, experiments by Rosenfeld and his group in 2017 did it using entangled atoms separated by hundreds of meters. And that was the moment that physics as a whole largely agreed. Local realism, as Einstein conceived it, is empirically false. It cannot describe our universe.
We have to accept either non-locality or non-realism.
One of them has to go.
But the story still doesn't end there. Because there's one final, incredibly deep assumption embedded in all of science that has to be dealt with. The freedom of choice loophole.
This one feels less like a technical problem and more like a cosmological one.
It really does.
It is entirely philosophical and cosmological. The whole of Bell's theorem assumes what we call statistical independence. It assumes the experimenter's choice of measurement settings, say the angle of polarizer, is truly free, random, and independent of the hidden variables, the lambda, carried by the particles being measured.
But what if it isn't? What if the hidden variables and the choice of settings were correlated by some common cause way back in the distant past, like right after the Big Bang?
Well, if that were true, then the violation of the inequality would be predetermined. It would be baked in from the start. And you wouldn't need non-locality to explain it at all. You would simply have a predetermined local universe that was set up to fool your experiment.
That is the freedom of choice loophole.
That's it. And to close it, you have to push the moment that the setting choice is made so far into the past that no reasonable physical process could have possibly correlated it with the particle emission source in your lab.
And that's where the cosmic Bell tests come in.
Yes. The ingenuity here is just off the charts.
So how do you use the entire universe to choose your experimental settings?
Physicists realized that if they based their measurement settings on light that had traveled for millions or even billions of years to reach their detectors, then any hypothetical common cause that could correlate the setting choice with the particle source would have to have happened before that light was emitted.
So instead of a grad student pressing a random button.
Right, or a random number generator. The angle of the polarizer is determined by, say, whether a photon arriving from a distant star has a certain polarization or intensity.
And the first major cosmic test was done in 2017.
Yes, by Hansteiner and his team. They used starlight that had traveled for 600 years. So this pushed the moment of freedom of choice back to the year 1417, which is a huge improvement.
But not quite cosmological.
Not yet. The real cosmological punch came later when teams used light that originated from two extremely distant quasars.
Quasars. Incredibly energetic, distant galactic cores. And they are old.
They are ancient. The light they used was generated approximately 8 billion and 12 billion years ago.
12 billion years ago.
Yes. So by the time that ancient light determined the measurement settings in the lab, any hypothetical correlation between those choices and the particles being measured would have had to originate at least 7.8 billion years ago.
You're pushing the conspiracy back almost to the Big Bang.
You're effectively excluding any possible predetermination that originated after the Big Bang within a massive fraction of the entire history of the universe.
That is just. It's utterly mind-boggling. We are using events that happened billions of years ago to try and guarantee that a choice we make right now in a lab is statistically independent.
The implication is massive. It means either non-locality is absolutely real, or the initial conditions of the universe, 13.8 billion years ago, were set up with such precise, fine-tuned causality that they predetermined not only the hidden variables of quantum particles, but also the entire evolutionary trajectory that led to human physicists building specific devices, and those devices selecting specific settings based on the arrival of 12 billion-year-old photons.
That sounds That sounds like a cosmic conspiracy.
He does. And that brings us to the final retreat for the diehard local realists.
Superdeterminism.
Superdeterminism. Despite the closure of every known experimental loophole locality, detection, and now freedom of choice, this one interpretation survives. And it survives because it is, by its very nature, immune to empirical falsification.
And why is that?
Because it challenges the most fundamental philosophical assumption in all of science. The statistical independence of the observed system from the observer's choice.
So superdeterminism is, at its heart, a deterministic interpretation of quantum mechanics.
Right.
It wants to keep hidden variables, and it wants to keep locality.
Yes, it clings to locality. But it does so by violating Bell's key premise about free choice.
That's the core of it. It postulates hidden variables, and it respects locality. It maintains that cherished classical idea that nothing travels faster than light. And it's mathematically allowed to do this, but only by sacrificing the principle of statistical independence. Let's really dwell on that term, statistical independence, for a moment, because it's everything. In simple terms, what does it mean to sacrifice it?
Okay. Statistical independence means that if I choose to set my detector polarizer at, say, 45 degrees, that decision is completely uncorrelated with the hidden variables, the lambda, that determine the properties of the photons that left the source 5 microseconds ago.
They're two separate things, my choice and the particle's properties.
Exactly. If you sacrifice this, you are saying the choice of 45 degrees is somehow correlated with those hidden variables. The system and the experimenter are not independent statistical entities.
Okay, so if the choice is correlated, how does that save locality? How does it explain the Bell violation?
Because the entire mathematical proof that leads to that classical limit of Sala 22 breaks down if the settings are not independent of the hidden variables. The proof relies on that assumption.
So it's a loophole in the math itself.
It's a loophole in the logical premise of the theorem. Superdeterminism suggests that the hidden variables of the particles were already correlated with the future measurement settings. Your A and B, way back when they were created, possibly at the Big Bang.
So the correlation pre-exists the experiment.
It does. And since the correlation is already there, there's no need for any non-local faster-than-light communication during the experiment. Everything just unfolds locally but deterministically.
This immediately brings us to the conspiracy objection that critics always raise. It sounds like it requires a universe that is constantly cheating the experiment.
It does feel that way. If superdeterminism is true, the universe must orchestrate this precise correlation. So, for instance, if the experimenter chooses setting A, nature has to ensure that the experiment receives only the specific subset of photons whose predetermined properties match setting A in just the right way to produce the quantum mechanical result, the S2 result.
And if the experimenter had chosen setting B instead,
then a different, equally specific, equally fine-tuned subcollection of photons would have been delivered to the apparatus to match that setting.
That sounds so incredibly fine-tuned. It sounds like magic. Why is that not just rejected out of hand as being unscientific?
Because the proponents argue that the charge of conspiracy is a philosophical one, not a scientific one. They say the conspiracy charge relies too heavily on what we call counterfactual definiteness.
On imagining what would have happened if you'd made a different choice.
Exactly, but isn't that how all of science works? We imagine what would happen if we changed the variables.
It seems to be.
But in a truly deterministic universe, counterfactuals get extremely tricky. The proponents draw parallels to philosophical literature on things like time travel or rigid determinism. They argue that when the thing you're imagining, the choice of a different setting, is hard to make true.
Because the choice itself was determined by the laws of the universe.
Right. Then it's entirely expected that the consequence will look highly coincidental. The apparent conspiracy is just a necessary feature of a fully determined reality where every single cause traces all the way back to the initial state of the universe.
So if the entire causal chain in the universe leads inevitably to me choosing polarizer setting A, then the statement, well, what if I had chosen setting B, requires fundamentally altering the initial conditions of the entire universe. And any coincidence that results from that is basically meaningless.
That's the argument, precisely. They shift the focus away from the practical coincidence to the logical inevitability under global determinism. And furthermore, they argue that while this statistical dependence exists in principle, because everything is connected back to some ultimate theory of everything,
in practice, it's negligible.
It's completely negligible in practice. The correlation needed to link a macroscopic knob setting to microscopic hidden variables is so incredibly weak and originated so distantly in time that it's totally unmeasurable by any means we have.
So it's an in-principle correlation. It's just enough to mathematically save locality, but it's irrelevant to our day-to-day experimental science.
That's the claim.
That is a fascinating escape hatch. It accepts all the empirical data, the Bell violation, but it preserves locality and realism by essentially saying, you never had a free choice in the first place, and that's why the correlation appeared.
And this philosophical stance is actually supported by some more radical deterministic frameworks. For example, the method of everything. This approach offers a completely different kind of logic, and it accuses standard science of having a built-in, unexamined bias.
Okay, let's get into that critique. How does the method of everything framework argue that our Bell experiments are fundamentally flawed because our logic is flawed?
They argue that mainstream physics, and really all of science, operates almost entirely on what they call effect-cause logic, or EC logic.
Meaning existence precedes cause.
Right. We observe a phenomenon, a photon hitting a screen, the existence or effect, and then we trace it back to a local cause, like a laser or a particle source.
That seems like standard observation. What's the alternative?
The alternative they propose, which they say comes from analyzing something called the Tempt Destiny experiment, is causal effect logic, or CE logic. And here, motion, the cause, supersedes existence, the effect.
So the ultimate cause is not the local source of the particle, but a predetermined non-local motion or selection process.
The motion of the universe dictates the reality we see, rather than the existence of a particle dictating its trajectory.
Okay.
And they say that this non-local motion predetermines outcomes through two mutually exclusive selection functions. There's direct selection, which leads to a single, certain output, and there's indirect selection, which results in an uncertain, more than one potential output.
And what's the critique of the Bell tests, then, in this framework?
The critique is that Bell-type experiments, specifically any experiment that relies on generating uncertainty, like using a beam splitter or measuring along non-orthogonal axes, are unknowingly invoking these indirect selection functions.
So by forcing uncertainty into a system that is, at its root, governed by deterministic motion,
you unintentionally generate the very uncertainty and correlation violation that you then observe. They claim the resulting violation of the Bell inequality is a false positive. It's an artifact of applying our flawed EC logic to a CE reality.
Wait, so the violation is a measurement error caused by a philosophical misalignment. If the universe is fundamentally deterministic and we use tools that generate uncertainty, we're guaranteed to see the violation.
That is the radical claim. The argument is that the experimenter's free choice, whether to use a beam splitter or set a polarizer at 30 degrees, is not some sovereign cognitive function.
It's just another effect.
It's a second-order effect of that predetermined non-local motion. As objects made of matter governed by physical laws, we human experimenters are bound by the exact same predetermined selection laws that govern the entangled particles.
So in this view, the assumption of free choice isn't just incorrect. It's logically incoherent within the true framework of reality.
Yes. This means superdeterminism isn't just saying our choices are correlated. It's saying our choices are fully predetermined effects within a complete deterministic chain, a chain that goes all the way back to the Big Bang.
It really challenges the very independence and objectivity we assume when we put on a lab coat. If your choice of what to measure is not statistically independent of what you are measuring,
then you haven't closed the freedom of choice loophole. You've just accepted that the loophole is an inevitable, fundamental reality of our existence.
Wow. This has been a monumental journey. We started with Einstein's demand for a complete, local, real universe.
A very sensible demand.
It seems so sensible. And that demand led to the rigorous mathematical proof of Bell's theorem, which forced us to accept that local realism is empirically impossible.
Decisive, Nobel-winning experiments, including tests that stretch billions of years into the cosmic past, have cemented the fact that our classical intuition is just. It's fundamentally broken.
And we are left with this stark choice, a trilemma forced on us by Bell's theorem. We must drop at least one of these three core assumptions.
Locality, realism, or statistical independence. One has to go.
If you drop locality and realism, you land on standard quantum mechanics, a fundamentally probabilistic universe with instantaneous non-local correlations, the spooky action.
Which is where most of the physics community has landed. But if you drop statistical independence, you can accept superdeterminism, a fundamentally deterministic and local universe.
But one where every measurement setting we choose is subtly perfectly correlated with the very particles we measure, challenging the bedrock of the scientific method itself.
What stands out to me is that the case against superdeterminism isn't based on any empirical data that contradicts it. It fits the data perfectly.
Right.
The case against it is purely on philosophical or methodological grounds. The charge that it's unfalsifiable or that it demands too great a cosmic coincidence from nature.
It's an interpretation that fits all the facts, but it challenges the very foundations of the method we use to acquire those facts.
And that's the ultimate intellectual tension here. We have all this empirical evidence leading us to the bizarre non-local conclusions of quantum mechanics, but then there's this philosophical pathway superdeterminism that allows us to cling to locality.
But the price is sacrificing free will and the idea of an objective, independent scientific inquiry. It turns the very definition of a test on its head.
It does.
So we'll end with this final provocative thought for you to mull over. Just consider the immense timescale of those cosmic Bell tests. If the settings for your experiment are influenced by light that began its journey 12 billion years ago, what does that really say about the ultimate definition of free choice that you bring into the lab?
Or perhaps more relevantly, the free choices you believe you make every day in your macroscopic life.
If all the empirical evidence points toward a reality where our choices are, at best, just pragmatic approximations, where does responsibility truly lie in a universe that might be completely, locally, and perfectly determined from the beginning of time?
That is a deep dive for another day.